And feel free if you have to stop. It's no problem. Today is Friday, the 30th of March, the year 2001. We're in East Lansing at the campus of Michigan State University. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Randall W. Scott for the Michigan State University Oral History Project. The sesquicentennial is coming up in 4 years, in the year 2005, and that's the purpose of this institutional oral history. Mr. Scott, you can see we've got tape recorder. Do you give us permission to record this?
I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with something about your personal and educational background. Were you born and raised, and where did you go to school before college?
I was born in Alpena, Michigan, in 1947. Grew up on a farm in Hubbard Lake, Michigan, and went to Alcona High School, which is the first of the 83 counties alphabetically and the last in terms of wealth and population. Mm-hmm. And came down to college at MSU in 1965.
Mm-hmm. Did you graduate in 65?
Graduated from high school in 65.
In 65, okay.
Right.
What type of farming did you do on your farm?
We were a beef farm. We were a beef breeder until about 1960, when I was just starting high school. We switched to chickens. Mm-hmm. So I came from a chicken farm.
Uh-huh. Did you have contact with the cooperative extension or any 4-H programs or anything like that, or did you, prior to coming as a student?
I had one in-school experience with 4-H, mm-hmm. but I wasn't in. Other kids were in the Future Farmers and mm-hmm. and worked in a lot in 4-H. They fed cows for the fair and this kind of stuff, but that wasn't how we approached life on our farm.
I think
we were future librarians or something like that, rather than farmers.
books were important. At
books
the time.
Were very important. Uh-huh. My grandfather's house and our house mm-hmm. Were both full of books.
Mm-hmm. So, who would you say had an important influence in your family on shaping you or directing you toward a life of books?
Both of my grandparents, my father's parents, were big readers and left or supplied many, many books, and that was real important. I started reading books that were printed in the 1920s, mm-hmm. and I was reading all the kids' books, you know, all the way up for uh-huh. 6 decades worth or so. Mm-hmm. And also my mother, although she never went to college, her sisters became teachers, and that was really highly valued in my mother's family. Mm-hmm.
What's your mother's name?
Bernice Nordstrom.
Nordstrom. Mm-hmm. How did you first become interested in coming to Michigan State as a student?
Well, specifically, when it came time to talk to the guidance counselor about where to apply and things like that. He was looking for ways to get me money, and Michigan State was giving out a lot of national merit scholarships. Mm-hmm. And since I had qualified for one, mm-hmm. We just sort of figured this was a good bet. And indeed, there were 250 of us or something when I arrived. Mm-hmm. So that was the recruiting. That was the basic recruiting. I did see a recruiter who came up there.
Mm-hmm. But, that was part of Dr. Sabine's program,
exactly.
I think.
Yes.
Did you come to meet him or know him at all? Or
no, I got letters from him, but uh-huh. I'm sure I saw him. Or we had meetings actually that first year in '65. All the scholars would get together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. If we can recruit for football, we can recruit for yeah. Academics too.
Well, I think I don't know if the university as a whole was satisfied with that, with the result or not. Mm-hmm. When I went to my, I don't know if this is getting ahead, but when I went to my first all-night demonstration, mm-hmm. There was a very high percentage of National Merit Scholars occupying that building.
This is what you get. When you came here, did you have an idea in advance when you came here of what you might major in?
I was told by my guidance counselor in high school that I needed to have a major.
Uh-huh.
So I picked math mm-hmm. because I liked math and I got good grades.
Did it come easily to you, or
it did through high school, and mm-hmm. it did for the first year of college. But mm-hmm. then I realized the joy was gone. And so starting my sophomore year, I went note riff for a while.
Okay. All right. So how would you describe the campus when you first got here? Any first impressions that you
I thought
stick
it was
in your mind?
A great place. You know, I was really impressed because I was right off the farm and I had never been out of Michigan or never been any farther south than Central before that. And so it was a big city and it was all new and I thought it was a wonderful place.
You know. Did you live in the dorm?
I lived in Abbott Hall.
Abbott. The do you remember, or how would you describe the campus in terms of the climate at the time in when you arrived?
People were hardworking and serious students, I thought. And on the other hand, there was this thing with Paul Schiff. And I had no idea of political involvement, radicalism, whatever, but Paul Schiff was a graduate student. As I remember, his assistantship hadn't been renewed because of some political activity. He had a little paper called Logos that he was passing out. And that was mysterious to me, because you know, I was right off the farm and I had no idea. And right away, the paper started, the underground paper started that same year. The editor, Mike Kinman, walked off the state news and started his own paper. This was all sort of interesting.
But and it was called The Paper.
The Paper. I had no idea what it was all about, but it was fascinating.
So you were reading that right along with
the state news.
State
right.
news. At least you're reading that. Students now sometimes don't even read the state news. How did you get involved in the Paul Schiff?
I didn't get involved.
You
in
didn't
that.
Get involved
that,
in
that.
That
was just
okay.
You know, later on, I figured out what was going on. Why these tall people in, it seemed like tall people in beards were handing out stuff.
Let's go back to some of your other undergraduate studies. What was your other some of the other areas that you took?
Since I was in the Honors College provisionally right away, so I didn't have to take ATL, but I did. And that was a favorite class, actually, it turned out. We read a lot.
Who did you have? Do you remember?
My first teacher was Dr. John Apple.
Okay.
And after that I had a Robert Fogarty. And after that I had another gentleman.
He wasn't meant to be a quiz, but
his name escapes me, but he has since died. Fogarty, of course, was one of the Orange Horse Three who were not given tenure by the ATL department. And that led to the radicalism because we had a demonstration in support of those guys.
You were had him while the Orange Horse Three was going on.
Right.
Could you maybe talk about it? I've talked with other people who had knowledge about that, but I'm interested. You're the first student that I had. Would you talk a little about maybe Fogarty as a teacher or how you got involved in it, in that Orange Horse Three? What was it called at the time? Incident or?
I can't remember. And it was named, I think, by the paper. And I don't know, I can't remember why it had an orange horse. I think it had something to do with the stadium being repainted, and they had an undercoat on it. It was orange.
The
superstructure of the stadium. And somebody, I think maybe Lawless, wrote a poem about the orange horse.
And then that caught on.
Yeah. The three guys were Fogarty, Lawless, and Grote. And I didn't know anything about the other two. Fogarty was a normal ATL teacher. I had an honors section, so we had a lot of slack in what we did, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. He didn't give me the best grades. I got a B. And so I had to go in and talk to him. And he bought a book of mine. He never gave it back.
Never gave it back.
But ATL was kind of a joy because there was so much reading. And this is what I'd grown up to want to do.
Or to expect at the college level.
Right, and it really, that fulfilled my expectations, no problem.
How did the demonstration develop? Was that in Bessie Hall?
That was in Bessie Hall. We went in there, stayed all night. Gary Snyder, the poet, came and read to us after he had a reading at the Kellogg Center. There were at least 100 people there. I remember Brad Lang, who did a survey of how many of us were National Merit Scholars and surprised everybody. That's how I happened to know. I think I wrote up the experience for the Northwest Complex newsletter, Northeast Complex, Abbott Hall, Mason Abbott, Snyder Phillips. I wrote up my experiences in that demonstration. It was a periodical called Impulse. Maury Crane was also writing for that as a young faculty member at the time. That's where I first heard his name.
But that was just an in-house newsletter, or was that a...
It circulated to all the kids in those four dorms.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was. But the editor had some literary pretension, so he was always putting poetry and stuff in there.
How would you characterize the administration's response to the whole situation or incident?
I didn't see any response. They let us stay there all night. There were no police, no excitement that I remember.
This was in 65 when you took ATL, or was it?
This would have been
66.
Spring 66.
Spring 66. Yeah.
If my memory serves me right, because that's when I had Fogarty winter term.
How did the situation of the war and the draft, and how did that affect your life? I mean, it's something a college student had to deal with.
Right. I had the student deferment, 2S was it? As long as I kept reporting to the draft board, and that was not a problem until. Later on in the story, I dropped out, and the draft board made me 4F, or not 4F, made me 1A.
1A.
Forget the terminology, and I went for my physical down in Detroit. And by then, I had joined the IWW because I was working on the paper. In the fourth year of the paper, I was its circulation manager or something like that. We made up titles. There were only about four of us. And I also edited the news. And so I checked on their list of subversive organizations, industrial workers of the world, at my physical. And this apparently required them to do an investigation, which they did.
Did that change your classification?
No, it didn't. Uh-huh. But it delayed it long enough so that the lottery came through.
In 1969?
And I got a good number.
Well.
So that was that.
My number was 19, so.
So you have to go.
I was in Central Michigan in 68 and as a freshman, and then 69 when the draft came. I had the student deferment until the end, but I did get drafted in 1972 at the very end. So they hadn't eliminated the draft by that time. But
yeah, I got a very high number, which at least. And by that time, I was in SDS, and I had better things to think about.
Now, you mentioned that you dropped out for a while,
I think I had less than a year to go when I finally dropped out.
But you came back.
I came back after I met Lynn, and we were thinking about getting married and that kind of stuff. Yeah, we were. I was in jail 9 times during that period.
Oh, really?
And the last time I got out, I told the judge, and I meant it, that I would go back to school, and I did.
what was your wife's maiden name?
Wasserman.
Wasserman. Yeah. Did you met on campus?
Yeah, neither of us were students at that time. I think we were technically outside agitators. Oh. The terminology they used at that time.
I see. So the war had, obviously, was your draft status and that. Though you were involved in some of the war protest.
Yeah.
And would you like to talk a little bit about that? What was going on campus, or how did students respond to the war?
My activity, I joined SDS In 1968, I was kind of late to it, and I was starting to finally figure out what was going on, what the protests in Chicago were about, and this kind of stuff. Because I felt like, you know, coming from a farm, from a chicken farm, this was a whole different culture. It wasn't even so much the facts, it was the culture of protest and an urban culture that was sort of difficult for me to catch on to. MSU at first felt like this institution where I could fit in just fine, being a farm person, because, you know, there were so many rules and everything, and I just had to follow them, and everything was cool. But it was about my third year when I finally skipped a class for the first time.
Third year. We won't ask you what that class was.
Well, I'll volunteer the information. It was a German class.
A German.
Because I did get into German right away as a freshman and studied that really hard and really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And that got me my job here, too.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Interesting how sometimes those end up later becoming part. Did you ever go to Germany?
Yeah, I went after my sophomore year with the MSU program, AMLEC it was called, and spent 2 months basically.
Mm-hmm. Does that program still continue?
I don't know. It might. I've heard about it in the last 5 or 6 years, I think. Yeah. But it was basically a language study program, mm-hmm. so we had classes all morning and then the afternoon off to go get in trouble. But it was after coming back from that I realized that there was something important to this political business, that SDS and the whole idea of Marxism, Leninism and all these things were worth checking out, because what I got in ETL didn't spell those out in any way. I'm sure you know.
So you continued with your study, I mean your reading? And
I continued reading. We had study groups with SDS. I went off to the summer project. That was in Detroit, the summer of 69. The school was over here, and I had already dropped out. I'd missed spring term, I believe. And the whole business with the lottery hadn't happened yet. I went off. The summer project was advertised by SDS as a way to seriously study the politics that we were attempting to understand and apply, and to try things, to work in factories and try to become revolutionaries. Like a school for revolutionaries.
Were the how would you characterize your position in terms of leadership of SDS in the area? Yeah, was there any organization at all, or
there was a pretty strict organization. By that time, by the end of June 69, SDS had split in three parts, and the summer project was the core of the Weatherman part, and so we had our weather bureau, 10, you know, highly visible, nationally known radicals like Bernadette Dorn and these kind of people were the leaders of the summer project. It happened both in Columbus and in Detroit. And I was not in any leadership role at all. I was, you know, except in karate class, sometimes I read the exercises. No, I was in what was called the living room crowd. And graduated to my own bedroom.
What was the target? Was it directed toward the draft, or was it just the war, U.S. participation? What would you say was the target by 69?
Yeah, well, anti-war activity and anti-racist activity were always in the background. The ideology we were trying to develop was some kind of a total anti-imperialism ideology that would include everything else. And we tried to, you know, we had speakers in from the Republic of New Africa and the black workers' organizations in Detroit. And we sponsored a brigade to cut cane in Cuba, the Venceremos Brigade. This kind of stuff. We were trying to be international. We sent a representative to Ho Chi Minh's funeral from our collective.
Oh, really?
And, you know, we got a lot of positive attention from the people around the world who were anti-imperialist. And basically our slogan was, we're not against the war, we're just on the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, we were trying to be, give some shock value to the whole, uh-huh. the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What, how would you characterize the movement as you were involved in terms of, was there actual discussions of targeting universities like Michigan State, or how was there any of that, say, to capitalize on the student unrest or student interest yeah. in the anti-war movement?
Most of us had come out of universities, obviously, mm-hmm. and part of our understanding was that the motion was in the youth. Mm-hmm. You know, other people looked at the workers and other people looked at the minorities, but, you know, we were a youth movement, mm-hmm. quote unquote. You know, it seems kind of silly sometimes now. Mm-hmm. But we were after high school kids a lot. You know, we went to a lot of high school kids, leafleting them, mm-hmm. trying to talk them into coming to meetings. And the summer sort of, after a couple months of pretty serious study groups where we studied a lot of, you know, the standard Marx and Lenin and Fidel and Juan Bosch and all kinds of leftist writers, it sort of, in my opinion, degenerated into this long, and we called it the Forced March, this long build-up toward the national action in Chicago that became the Days of Rage. It was later named that.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in that?
I was arrested there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my biggest arrest for sure. I spent 2 weeks in the Cook County Jail. Mm-hmm. And was ultimately sentenced to 2 years of probation. Mm-hmm. And I reported to my probation officer, and that was over.
Were you living in Michigan at the time?
I was. Uh-huh. Although I got permission for the first couple months to move to Boston for the summer. Mm-hmm. But then I came back.
Mm-hmm. Was that the judge that you told you were going back to school? Or?
No, that was a judge in Grand Rapids.
Oh.
In my capacity as an outside agitator, let's say, a couple of us went from Detroit to Grand Rapids to support the SDS collective there who wanted to demonstrate against Spiro Agnew, mm-hmm. who was dedicating a new city-county building. And so I think four of us went or something like that in cooperation with the local radicals, and maybe 20, 25 people altogether. We marched around this big crowd, mm-hmm. chanting, "Screw you, Agnew! Screw you, Agnew!" Well, apparently they heard us, because mm-hmm. the police came in great force and arrested everybody they could catch, and I was easily caught. And I spent 6 months with 1 month off for good behavior in the Grand Rapids County Jail. Mm-hmm. On the charge of attempted resisting arrest.
Mm. Oh. Interesting. And what year was that? 70? Or was it in the 60?
The arrest was in late 69.
69, okay.
And the jail time, I got out May 14th, 1970.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on at that time.
And I had told the judge during that space that I was going to go back to school, so that's when I did. I went back. I believe summer term 70.
So you were here summer term of 1970. So just after Kent State, which would have been May 4th of 70.
I was still on probation, so I decided I wasn't going to go out in front of any cops. So I was a good boy. Mm-hmm. But other people went to demonstrations all around the country around that time, around Kent State. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. When you came back, what was the focus of your study on campus?
I was trying to just put it together, what I had done before, and try to make a degree out of it.
Uh-huh.
And I turned out to be a humanities major,
okay.
which just means that you take three areas, two of them in the humanities and one hopefully out of the humanities was their thing. And my first year in math got me a math concentration. I had to do one more course. And German, all the German I had studied, gave me a German concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was linguistics. I was always interested in languages.
Okay.
So I had taken Spanish and French too, mm-hmm. Japanese. Mm-hmm. And so linguistics was the third one. Then I used French or Spanish as the language requirement. And mm-hmm. since I was in the Honors College for the first 2 years, although not later, they decided I could waive natural science and humanities. Well, I took some of those.
Was that in Justin Morrill College or?
No.
No, it was
just just a regular humanities major, okay. And a divisional major. That
when they had the humanities department?
Yeah. Or no, it was, was right through the College of Arts and Letters, straight.
Okay.
They might still, they probably still have that.
Interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary.
Yeah, right. And it turns out that's a perfect thing to do if you're going to be a librarian, mm-hmm. Concentration in a couple areas and, mm-hmm. and go on to library school, which I eventually did.
Mm. But after you came back, so when did you graduate again? In undergraduate?
71, I think.
Uh-huh.
I wrote that down somewhere. 72. After graduation, when I got back from jail the last time, I went to work at Curious Bookshop.
Okay.
That's important.
Right.
Because of the colorful things you see around me.
Yeah. Was Ray Walsh the owner then?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He was the originator of it.
I see.
And I had worked with him as a student in the library. We were students together.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me the job. It was $1 an hour. But I was really doing things I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of refocused from all the politics, which I don't think really was me in the first place,
mm-hmm.
and got back into science fiction and comics and mysteries. And
you were interested in that? Oh, in that area?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I always had been. I mean, a lot of the things in my grandmother's house were Tom Swift books.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So I was reading kids' books from ages ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Rover Boys, and I feel sometimes like an anachronism because I read long lists of all these old series books for kids,
mm-hmm.
from the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at Curious then until 73, when the dollar an hour sort of got on my nerves. I finally got a job here,
mm-hmm.
as a clerk.
Okay. As a clerk in the library?
Clerk, yeah, as a typist.
Mm-hmm. Where did you ultimately go to grad school?
In Columbia University, mm-hmm. in the city of New York, as their letterhead says.
Did you anticipate, or at what point did you make the decision you were interested in the library?
I'd always wanted to move toward books, and that's why I'd gone to Curious.
Mm-hmm.
And here, what happened was Russell and I had donated a collection of, well, almost everything, but especially in my case, comic books that I was interested in. And somebody had stolen Spider-Man number one, and it made it to the papers, and I was sitting upstairs typing, and I said, well, I see an opportunity. And I went downstairs and offered my help, and the first thing we did, they accepted, was put ownership stamps on all the comic books so that Ray couldn't resell them right away like he had the first Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
He had
sold it.
Yeah, the guy had run straight across the street, sold it for $50, and Ray had resold it for some other amount, and it was gone.
So that was the first.
That was when I realized that I guess I sort of knew the collection was here because mm-hmm. Russell and I had been a customer at Curious Bookshop too,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and he was this cool old guy who came in and bought Joe Palooka comics or whatever.
You know when he started his collection? Or had he always collected as a young man? Or?
Well, no, he was writing for a book. He was writing a book called The Unembarrassed Muse.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of required chapters on all the different genres of popular culture as we still know them. And so he didn't do things by halves. I mean, if he was going to write something about soap operas, he watched soap operas. Mm-hmm. He was going to write about comics, he bought a bag of comics and took them home.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us his comics and all the other things, too. But he also talked two of his students into giving us their comics. So about in 1970, somewhere along that time, before I was actually here, the library got 6,000 comic books. Because of Russell Nye's,
mm-hmm.
What do you call it? Arm twisting.
I see.
And so in 73, when I heard about this, I came down here, and I had already developed certain skills at the Curious Bookshop for sorting and knowing the subtleties of you know, what were the good ones and what were the tricky parts of organizing this stuff.
Were there any other academic institutions that were collecting comic books, or obviously private collections? But
Bowling Green
at your time. Oh, Bowling Green.
Bowling
okay.
Green at that time, and right. and Russell and I had his opposite number, Ray Brown.
Ray Brown.
And actually, Russell and I used to go down there with shopping bags of stuff too. I mean, he's famous for he spread it around.
Where he donate some stuff down there?
Right,
or
yeah. I mean, he was in here every couple of days with a shopping bag of stuff that had come from somewhere that he thought should be in the collection. Because we're talking about mass culture, and the word mass is to be taken seriously.
Yeah,
it's not just a mass medium; it's a massive medium, right? Massive set of media.
What do you remember about your graduate work? Did you anticipate that you'd come back here, or
I had hoped
was
so.
That the that you were interested in? And you were married at that time?
Yeah. The reason I decided to go, and Lynn prompted me, but I was sitting upstairs still typing, and there were all these great comic books down here. So I had an independent study with Russell and I, where we worked out together a system for cataloging the comics. And a rationale and a plan, you know, what would be acceptable, what would be the useful collection. However, the library wouldn't let me implement it because I wasn't of the right status.
I see.
To be to actually touch the typewriters that make the cards, you need to have an MLS.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
We didn't even have computers yet.
That made the difference, yeah.
So that convinced me, you know. I started applying and got a good deal at Columbia. And we were gone for a year and a half, a year and a summer. And they had a search committee looking for